Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. The House passes a bill authorizing the raising of the debt ceiling just in time to avoid default. The Senate follows suit. It goes to the president's desk to be signed. A human chain formed by parents and students brings attention to just how unhappy some are over new school boundaries in southern Mecklenburg. The UDO, the Unified Development Ordinance, passed last year by Charlotte City Council, went into effect yesterday. We'll talk about that. Want to bet on whether our legislature will okay sports betting in North Carolina? It's on the table in Raleigh. And Charlotte fire officials consider new regulations after a huge construction fire near South Park. Here to discuss those stories and more is Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. Good morning, Eli. Welcome.
Morning. Happy Friday.
Morning. Hunter Sines is here. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, Hunter.
Howdy, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is back. She's a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Mary, welcome.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberger is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Look at you. The most casual of us all. Good morning.
Greetings, Mike. I have my public radio nerd shirt on. I figured that qualifies.
That's good. It does. Okay, so with just days before the deadline, which is Monday, on raising the debt ceiling to avoid the default, the House of Representatives successfully approved raising it, making budget cuts as part of the package which they sent to the Senate. The vote in the House was 314 to 117. The vote in the Senate last night, 63 to 36. So that bill now goes to the president's desk for his signature. This was a compromise on both sides, and compromise, as we all have come to learn, is a dirty word in Washington. If lawmakers wanted to be responsible, however, did they really have any choice in this? Eric?
No, they did not have any choice. And as many people know, this is, a silly fight. We've turned what used to be a mere formality into a political cudgel. And I guess the best we can say is that they took it to the last hour, but did not go past the last hour.
Well, they could have taken it.
I have to second what Eric said. I mean, this, particularly during other administrations, the Trump administration, it was raised routinely. As people have pointed out, this is paying your bills. And a lot of this should be taking place, a lot of this discussion, during the appropriation and budget procedures, not now. And it's to no one's interest to tank the economy, to ruin the reputation of the United States. But it is, of course, an opportunity for much, much political posturing. Yeah. And because of the complaints on the left and the right, basically, I would say it was kind of a win for President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. And they also pushed the next one until past the 2024 election. So no one will have to deal with it until then.
Well, it may be. I think it is unequivocally a win for the president. It remains to be seen whether it's a win for Kevin McCarthy, because the right wing of that party has the ability to vote him out, and they are not happy. Those who opposed this effort were adamantly against it, among them Republicans in the North Carolina delegation, who were described by the Charlotte Observer as battling one another until the last minute. It turns out they all voted in favor of it, except for one person, Representative Dan Bishop. He spent nearly 4 days speaking out against the bill and was practically apoplectic about one of the key provisions, which extends that debt ceiling, as Mary mentioned, until after the 2024 election cycle.
And what does the device of 2 years do? It removes the issue from the national conversation during the presidential election to come. How could you more successfully kneecap any Republican president than to take that issue out of his or her hands?
He sees no benefit in this bill at all.
The only thing we get here is tokenism, a token, artificial, fake, nothing benefits. And you don't even need to talk that long as I have to Americans, for them to understand $4 or $6 trillion in debt growth. That is insane.
Now, the debt ceiling is something that needs to be addressed, as does the national debt. But the debt ceiling was raised several times, as Mary pointed out, during the Trump administration, and nobody said boo about it. And 25% of the debt, I believe, comes from those years. in the White House. Why are Republicans so dead set against this now, since they did it without a peep during the Trump years and prior to that?
What do you think? What's different now?
Well, Dan Bishop did say the quiet part out loud, that this is partially a lot about using as a political cudgel for the upcoming election. He basically said it plainly. He didn't say anything about the United States economy. So that's, of course, a big deal. And I would have to say there are legitimate concerns over debt. This deal saves $1.5 trillion over the decade. And each side, as I said, got some things. There was some increase in the work requirements for food aid, but it protects Social Security, Medicare, and some other things as well. But we still see, as you said, some opposition from Dan Bishop. And also, if you look at what the senators from the Carolinas did, Tom Tillis was the only senator that voted for it. Of course, we have Ted Budd, who voted against it. And in South Carolina, you have Senator Lindsey Graham, who was very adamant about the party of Ronald Reagan and saying that it didn't do enough to keep the military budget and the defense budget up with inflation. And for Tim Scott, of course, he is running for president. So he's trying to shore up his conservative bona fides.
Except it seems to me that a person running for president should have a basic understanding of how the world economy works and how it depends on the full faith and credit of the United States of America. Eli.
Well, you're saying this too.
I'm saying this, yeah. Eli.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of political posturing and also, as Mary said, some concerns about the debt. Ralph Norman from Rock Hill, just south of Charlotte, said that on our current trajectory, our interest payments will outweigh or overshadow, be more than our military budget. So, that is something that, he's really talking about there. But also, I think it foreshadows some divisions we're going to see between Republicans in the 2024 cycle here. As you pointed out, we've got kind of a Carolina-centric Republican fight here. Patrick McHenry on one side negotiating on behalf of leadership and whipping votes in favor of this. Dan Bishop, one of the most strident folks against on the House Freedom Caucus side. And I really think that, we have to figure, is this going to be something we'll see more of during the presidential primary and the other primaries we have here in the Carolinas?
I was going to jump ahead to Ralph Norman, but we'll go in the order as was planned for the time being. Jeff, I think we have bipartisan agreement that something has to be done about spending and about the national debt. And Jeff Jackson, the senator of the House of Representatives, member from Mecklenburg County, I guess it was the TikTok video. I'm not sure what it was, because he's famous for his TikTok videos, in which he talked about having this really serious conversation about spending, about the fiscal health of the country. But he said that going into default would simply make things worse.
If you think the national debt is a really big problem, then you really don't want us to default, because the first thing that happens, according to the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, we go into an instant recession. Millions of people lose their jobs.
And this passed both the House and the Senate with bipartisan support. Yes, you had Republicans voting no. You also had Democrats voting no, but the majority of both voted yes. And North Carolina Representative Patrick McHenry played a key role, along with House Speaker McCarthy, in negotiating the deal with President Biden. This is how he, Patrick McHenry, positioned the deal prior to the vote on CNBC's Squawk Box.
In a negotiation, you're not going to get everything you want. And we didn't get everything we wanted. House Republicans, we don't have a majority in the Senate. Republicans don't have a majority in the Senate, and Joe Biden's certainly not a Republican. So we had a really tough negotiation, but we had good conservative wins.
And he told CBS 17 in Raleigh-Durham that this was a win.
What we would say is, hey, as law enforcement, we want to be notified right away. We want to be able to talk to witnesses.
No, that's the wrong. Take that out. That is clearly wrong. But still, according to Dan Bishop, he called the bill a betrayal by McCarthy and McHenry. And he told Spectrum News Capitol Hill reporter Reuben Jones he had no confidence in his North Carolina colleague, Patrick McHenry.
Congressman, you said you don't have confidence in Speaker McCarthy. What's your confidence level in your North Carolina colleague, Patrick McHenry, in the negotiations?
Patrick was doing what Kevin wanted him to do.
Are you disappointed with how he did?
Yes.
There you go. Pretty curt. The House Freedom Caucus voted against the bill, and South Carolina's Ralph Norman, who Eli mentioned a moment ago, was among the most vocal of those opposed.
The interest on the debt is going to exceed our military budget if we keep going the way we're going. Somewhere, somebody has got to stop it.
He's right. And we keep hearing this from both sides. Why don't they begin those discussions?
I think anyone who observes Washington can answer that question pretty easily. I mean, you know, you only want spending to be curbed when the other side is in power. And then when you're in power, you pretty much want to pursue your priorities. And I think we see that play out time after time in Washington and elsewhere, I should say, just Washington.
But clearly over time, and it's not that long a period of time, this is going to prove to be unsustainable.
Yeah, as Eric mentioned, though, it's a matter of priorities. You could see it now where a lot of Republicans really want to hit a lot of the domestic spending, some of the climate spending in there. And the Democrats are saying, no, that's not negotiable. Let's look at some of the other budgets we want to curb back. You know, they had wanted to put some money in there for the IRS to go after what they feel are some of the very, very wealthy who are getting away with actually kind of not paying their full amount of taxes. And some of that money was pulled back as a compromise for Republicans. So it's going to be very, very difficult to figure out to make the deal based on what the priorities of the different parties are.
I think it's
to your point, though. So Mary just mentioned $1.5 trillion, which I think is over a decade that would be cut in spending. Deficit's $30 trillion. I mean, we're talking about, you know, money in the sofa at this point because it's nowhere near enough to make a meaningful difference. So everyone has their talking points and they're, sort of spreading the joy of their political victory. But there's not much meaningful change in this other than we are averting financial disaster. That's kind of important.
Eric, you write about business and money. It seems fairly elementary school level math to figure out that if you spend a lot of money, you have to have revenue coming in. And if you don't want to raise taxes, and Republicans don't want to raise taxes, they want to cut taxes, then you have to collect the taxes that you are reasonably expected to collect. And cutting money from the IRS seems to defeat that and defeat your ability to pay your bills. I just don't
understand. There's no question. I mean, that makes no sense. I will say this is no defense of cutting the IRS budget or not collecting taxes, because that's just simply insanity. I will say, as an aside, when you look at government, it is different than business in that you can run deficits and typically do run deficits. Mm-hmm. It's the sustainable levels. So government, you know, is not a business. It can run differently. You do have those guaranteed revenues, but there is a point, as you say, where it gets so out of whack that then things start to go, let me use a technical economic term, kaplooey.
So
and
Eric,
why this is political in the IRS, remember that the federal government, particularly the IRS, has become a political talking point as well.
Yeah.
On the right, saying that they are part of the deep state. And so it's not just a matter of economics. This is also mixing with the political rhetoric.
So I have 30 seconds left, Eric. It seems to me that when we faced this in the past, the markets have reacted to it. And I was going to ask you whether or not you think they would react favorably today to this worldwide, to the fact that we're not going to go off the financial cliff. But it seems to me that it's already factored in. We've cried wolf so many times, they didn't react going forward, and they haven't reacted this morning, have they?
Yeah, you saw a little bit of jitters, but not a whole lot. And yes, I think that, as I said, this averts disaster, but it's not a huge win.
Speaking of disaster, the schools want $2.5 billion in a bond issue, and the county commission this week came really close to saying, we don't think so. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. Hunter Sines is here from WSOC-TV. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, the Charlotte Business Journal. And Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Eli, the Mecklenburg County Commission has been considering County Manager Dina DiIorio's proposed budget for a couple of weeks, and yesterday morning they gave preliminary approval to it through a straw vote. It's a $2.3 billion budget, but there's also the CMS budget request of $2.5 billion to be put forth in November as a bond package. That all squeaked by on a 5-3 vote. Pretty close. What does that portend? Is that a warning shot for the final vote?
Yeah, so the straw votes are about what to include in the final budget and what to take out. And one of the things that was really controversial was this bond package. It would be the biggest that CMS has ever had, and it will require raising property taxes in future years to pay it back. Kind of like we were just talking about with the national debt. This will be money that we borrow to fund school construction. And a core of three commissioners basically came out and said, hey, this is too much. What about $1 billion? That's still a lot of money for CMS. We could have future bonds if they still need it after that, but 2.5 is too much. And they were worried about this property tax increase in the future. It passed, but narrowly. And, you know, Pat Cotham, one of the commissioners who voted against the bigger bond package, said, hey, there's a lot of anger at CMS right now, still lingering pandemic anger and, you know, the South Boundary dispute that I know we're going to talk about. And she said, I'm worried that this isn't going to pass, that people are going to come out against it, that it's a bad year for it. And I think that this is foreshadowing of what we could see in the lead up to the vote on these bonds in November, because a 5-3 vote, that's only a one vote margin. If they had deadlocked at 4-4, I don't know where we would be right now, because they would not have had the votes to include that in the final budget request. So it was a lot closer than I'm sure CMS wanted to see.
Here's what Commissioner Pat Cotham said exactly.
We talk about raising taxes, but that also means that is going to raise rents for a lot of people in our county that are already struggling, because we have so many homes that are owned by corporate landlords, and they're going to push that on their renters, and I am terrified of that.
Pat Cotham is one of the three no votes, along with Vilma Leek and Arthur Griffin, who is a former head of the school board. And when the former head of the school board votes no,
mayday.
Yeah, mayday. However, George Dunlap, the chair, who has certainly had his set of disagreements with CMS over the years, he had a different point of view.
We need to make sure that our kids are in the best learning environment. And that's what this bond request reflects.
Arthur Griffin, the former head of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board, now on the county commission, wanted to cut $1 billion from this $2.5 billion bond package. What should we take from that?
Yeah, it's going to be tough to, you know, see how this moves forward without any controversy. A lot of times these bond packages pass with really healthy margins. But, you know, if this is any indication, we could be looking at a harder fight. And one thing Arthur Griffin said was, he said, hey, I wish we could fund even more. I would give him $5 billion if I could, was what he said. But he just doesn't think that, given the increases we've seen already in property taxes, even before we get to future years to pay this bond back, that it's the responsible move right now.
Go ahead, Eric. I'm sorry.
I was just going to mention real quick, when Charlotte Mecklenburg passed the $1 billion bond, which was what, 2019?
17,
I'm sorry. That was the largest in the state at the time. And then I think there was another county that passed $1.7 billion a couple of years later. So this is it's significantly larger than what has ever been passed in the state. So I think Eli's absolutely right. This is going to be difficult.
I asked this question when we talked about this last week. I'm going to ask it again. I don't think anybody can answer it, but I'm just going to raise the question. We know in Raleigh they are considering expanding opportunity scholarships to every student in the state, therefore tying money for education to students and not school systems. And if this passes, a significant number, it would seem to me, of people over time will take advantage of it. Private schools may not be able to handle the influx right away, but certainly they will build that up, that capacity up over time. So that threatens the expansion of public schools. So why are we spending all this money to fund 30 projects to renovate, replace, or build new schools before we know what will happen in Raleigh. Is that a smart thing to do, Eli?
Well, it's sort of chicken and egg, I think, because one thing George Dunlap pointed out, as we heard, was there's a lot of aging CMS facilities. Another thing he mentioned was, you know, there's classrooms without windows, classrooms without, you know, adequate climate control, things that need to be replaced. So if we don't invest in the schools, the public schools, that makes privates even more appealing. So, you know, I think it's a little circular that way. At the same time, there's also, because this is a bond that has to go on the referendum, the November ballot for a referendum, there's really no way for them to delay this and see what happens in Raleigh or see what happens down the line. They really have to vote on it now to get it on the ballot in November.
Eric.
And to Eli's point, I think the other political fight or talking point you're going to see quickly is more people take those vouchers, go to private schools, and then people who want to cut public school funding will see, look, they have a choice and they're going private. They're not going public. So, yeah, if you let it erode further, I think that's probably the motivation in part for doing this now.
It's part
of
the
plan. And to
follow
up on what Eli said about aging facilities, I just today heard about so many schools that are closing and not having classes because of the climate and it's too warm and these kids can't go there. And as he said, if you have these aging facilities that can't accommodate, it really is going to mean the deterioration of a lot of public schools. And as both Eric and Eli have said, then that will be another selling point for folks to take the kids out of those schools. And for many people, that's the point.
So getting back to Pat Cottam and her comments about this a moment ago, she was worried that parents are angry about redistricting. They're angry about what happened during the pandemic to education levels, et cetera. And she's worried about what they will do at the ballot box. Is she saying that she thinks that the anger is sufficient for us to put this on the ballot only to see it be voted down by voters? Is that what she's saying?
Yes, that's what she's saying. And, you know, we're going to be in an off-year election, typically very low turnout on these odd-year elections. And I know we're going to talk about the South County boundary issues, but you've got a core of really involved, really high voter percentage parents who might be really angry depending on what happens at the school board on Tuesday. It's almost guaranteed some of them will be. So, you know, that's what she's saying. In part, she's worried about a setup in November that would not be good for the bonds. And then we're really back at square one.
And those angry parents made their anger known this week when students and parents from Myers Park High School, Alexander Graham Middle School, and Sharon Elementary School formed a human chain in protest.
I think it was all a little sudden and everyone kind of took it by shock and it was kind of like, oh, this is really last minute and very drastic.
That's student Cicely Pano speaking to WSOC-TV. She was part of the chain. What specifically, Hunter, are they upset about?
So what they are upset about is students go from Sharon Elementary to Alexander Graham to Myers Park High School. That is how it currently goes. But the change would be sending some students from Alexander Graham Middle to South MEC. And parents are really frustrated about this because this plan was never in any of the drafts until here recently. And now it has been stuffed in there for this vote that's supposed to happen next week.
Is that because they drew a plan and people didn't like it, so they went back and drew another plan, and I don't think people liked it very much, and so this is the result of that process?
Correct. And I don't think you're ever going to make anybody happy, and these parents know
Absolutely.
That they have said that. But the problem is these parents feel like they were left out, and then at the 11th hour they are now being impacted by this.
And in this case, they may have a point because these three schools are essentially next door to each other.
Within a few miles.
Yes. And one of the parents, Ashley Stokes, told Channel 9 that it makes more sense to have rising freshmen stay on what is essentially the same campus instead of going to South MEC.
We're trying to illustrate how difficult this might be for a child who just recently learned this news to, right before high school starts, to go to a new place.
So this is the result of adding this to the second plan that people protested about at a recent school board meeting. And I believe in that meeting or around that meeting, the new superintendent, Crystal Hill, said she was done drawing plans. But evidently they are drawing a new plan for Tuesday night. Is that true? Is that what's going on?
So the superintendent wants them to vote on this recommended plan. Okay. But the thing is they can technically vote to adopt, reject, or modify it. She doesn't want them to kick the can down the road. She wants a decision, but we will see what happens Tuesday.
This is always emotional because people make real estate important life decisions on where kids go to school. And when you get kids at the high school level, they want to be a Myers Park High School kid, or they want to be a South Meck High School. They don't want to change.
They want to stick with all of their friends.
They were friends, yeah.
Exactly right. It's a tough, impossible situation. Crystal Hill, the new superintendent, also this week spent some time shaking up the front office. She named a new deputy superintendent, a new chief human resource officer, a new chief financial officer, a new chief of staff, and a new associate superintendent for human resources. They're all from outside the CMS system. Was that expected? Is that normal? Did she say how she felt these choices might improve things?
I think it's always expected that, you know, the new boss is going to bring in some of their people. You tend to see that in any department. But this was really quick, especially, you know, since there was a pretty quick selection process for her, you know, just a few months. So that indicates this has been going on behind the scenes, lining this up. You know, you don't just get a half dozen high level folks in 1 week to agree to come over. So I think that this indicates that, you know, Crystal Hill is serious about leaving her imprint on this district, on mm-hmm. shaking things up, and on really not just going along with the way things have been done before. And for people who are critical of CMS, I'd imagine that there might be some optimism that these are folks from other districts, but it's also a big change in a district that has really seen a lot of change, even turmoil at the top in the past few years.
So was there a run on Banker's boxes at Office Depot this week? What happens to the old occupants of these positions?
That, I think, is a little bit less clear. Some have been reassigned to other positions. CMS did say, you know, some of them have they listed roles that other existing folks will do now. But yeah, you have to imagine that there were some resumes being printed this week.
Mary. And I want to jump in here just to say, again, schools, teachers, from teacher pay to what is being taught, it's also a huge political issue. So beyond the practical issues that CMS has to deal with, there's an overarching view that education, particularly public education, public school teachers are in the crosshairs.
Dr. Mandy Cohen, at one point in time, was the head of she was North Carolina's health secretary, and she was a frequent guest on this program during the pandemic because she really laid the ground rules for this state and how it was going to handle it. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that President Biden plans to name Dr. Cohen as the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. But, Eli, it's not final. The decision is not final. What's the holdup? I'll tell you what the holdup is, since I've stumped the panel.
We were not in those meetings with the White House.
Well, I was, and they're putting together the necessary paperwork to make the appointment official, but she is the leading candidate. But nobody's talking about this. The White House is mum. She is being quiet about this, and I guess that's just pro forma, right, at this stage of the game?
Yeah, absolutely. You can do nothing but harm yourself. But, you know, Mike, it is interesting. Mary mentioned when we were doing the preparation for the show, this is a political job now, obviously, having come through the pandemic. And also, it's a really big job, 11,000 employees. So, you know, this is a lot of responsibility. But this is someone who, as you said, has run the state health department, was part of the Obama administration. So she is very seasoned in these types of matters.
Okay, so we'll look. Maybe she'll come on the program as the head of the CDC.
We'll see. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Exactly right.
Let's hope
maybe
we don't have another pandemic, right? But you never know.
That's right. So, Hunter, schools are about to get out. Some have already let out for the summer, and CMPD is sounding the alarm. They are concerned about a spike in juvenile crime. And I was going to ask how this might be different from any other summer when kids are out and they play pranks or they get into trouble because they have too much free time on their hands. But your reporting reveals a troubling spike or string of young people being accused of violent crimes in the area. Talk about that.
Yeah, so it seems like every week we are going on the air with a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old. A couple weeks ago, we had a 6-year-old involved in an attempted robbery of a woman. And so, I mean, just to put it in perspective, last year there were 238 juveniles at CMPD arrested for gun-related crimes. That's not even all crimes. And then to think of it this way, nearly 1,000 juveniles were victims of gun-related crimes. So we are seeing this pattern continue, whether it's from the TikTok challenges of how to steal Kias and Hyundais to shootings of other teenagers. So CMPD is just trying to sound the alarm to tell parents that don't let your kids sit idle this summer. There are so many programs, including free programs. There are nonprofits. CMPD even puts on programs just to try to keep kids off the street and knowing where your kids are.
Well, you spoke with the CMPD Lieutenant Kevin Pietras. I think that's how you say his name. He told you it's time for a gut check. What are we supposed to do with that?
It's hard. Nobody has a single solution. I think the frustration is that, you know, for, you know, decades ago, we were used to a lot of these crimes being committed by adults, and to see it be younger and younger kids. And this has so many repercussions. It's not only kids who are falling victim of this, but then it's going through the juvenile court system and these really bad charges sticking with you for much of your life. So yeah. I don't think that kids maybe these days understand the gravity of some of the consequences of the actions that they're taking part in.
And as Hunter said, a lot of these are gun crimes. So remember, you might have a shoving match, a shouting match, a fight, something like this. So many of these things are now ending with people pulling out guns, even kids. And as Hunter says, you know, this is real. This is final.
Yeah, we've had two or three incidents this week of gunfire downtown in the daytime. So this is a serious problem, and we'll keep our eyes on it. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the UDO, which went into effect yesterday at long last, and also some sports betting possibilities coming out of Raleigh. That and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor at WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist at RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV Channel 9. Charlotte's new unified development ordinances, mythic in their proportions, approved last year by City Council, went into effect yesterday, June 1st. 650 pages of new regulations designed to guide future growth. This grew out of the 2040 comprehensive plan that the former City Council argued over for decades, it seemed. It was merely 9 months, perhaps, but it seemed forever. Remind us of what the UDO is and some of the things that it regulates.
Well, of course, it's the first Declaration of Independence. No, that was a different show. Never mind. It is the document that guides all kinds of matters related to how we grow. So the height of buildings, sidewalks, tree canopy, even mild-mannered things, Mike, like whether you would put a duplex or a triplex in a single-family zoned neighborhood, those kinds of things that might just slide by you. All that is part of your local Mecklenburg UDO, which you're celebrating right now.
Yeah, and the duplexes and triplexes have come up again in conversation, as have drive-through restrictions for restaurants. That's where the rubber meets the road, literally. They seem to be backtracking on this or having second thoughts about it and approving things that the UDO was supposed to prevent. Can we anticipate more picking apart of this document as time goes on?
I think Eli is, Eli, you got to jump in. I can tell you're ready.
Yeah. You know, this is something that urban planning folks have been concerned about is, hey, these are big changes in some sense for Charlotte, like putting more density in single family neighborhoods, moving away from drive-throughs, making it harder to build those. And there's been some hesitancy around city council to actually do things like, you know, heaven forbid, vote against a drive-through in a dense area. That is something, you know, that the plan would contemplate, but that city council has said no to. They're also going back and studying the duplex and triplex regulations that everyone has talked about and heard about so much. Those are only a small part of the UDO, as Eric pointed out, but they are definitely the lightning rod. And what the city says is, hey, this is a living document. We're going to change it as it comes up. We anticipate changes. But there's been a lot of frustration among, I would call them the urban planning Twitterati set, about the real hesitation to jump in and pursue some of this stuff with, you know, with gusto.
As you mentioned, it's a living, breathing document. That's how it's positioned, I suppose. And in fact, it is, because I was surprised to find that the city council is still seeking guidance from neighborhoods on what they want as this plan rolls out. I thought this plan put into the code the aspirations of the 2040 plan. Why? I thought they hammered all this out. Why are they still seeking opinions?
Well, it's a multi-stage process. You know, there's the vision, then there's the rules and the plan, then there's individual neighborhood plans, then there's rezoning cases as they come up. So, you know, I would think about it as the UDO and the city's vision are kind of like a big menu, and then the neighborhood plans are like the recipe that the chef's using. But then when the chef's back there in the kitchen, they still get to adjust the ingredients as they cook. So it is not a single, here it is, it's in effect, it's done forever. Charlotte's plan is set for the next 30 years. Good luck, folks.
It's the like longest meal to cook.
And everybody's hungry again by the end.
I know, right. Yes.
It's never done.
Now, Eli.
An artist has to know when his work is done, but a city never stops growing. It's always under construction. Okay, several weeks ago, there was this massive fire, Hunter, because you reported on that. I think you are on the scene for much of this. This massive fire at an apartment construction site near South Park. Two construction workers lost their lives in that blaze. And the next day, the Mecklenburg County Fire Marshal sent an email to the North Carolina Chief Fire Code Consultant saying there may be an opportunity, his word, to discuss updates to the state's fire codes. There are indications that may now happen. So what's under discussion?
So basically, one of the updates would be, before you have a construction like the one that burned down, there should be a study to ensure both past and active fire protections for that site, and they should be installed, of course, beforehand. And then there should also be a plan to separate this construction with any nearby construction. Of course, as you can imagine, they don't want any fire to jump and spread onto nearby buildings. This building was very tucked near other towers and other buildings under construction, as well as a senior living facility. And then they also want to do implement to where you need a plan to study your plan of evacuation. If you remember, 15 people had to be rescued from this. Two people died because they could not physically get out and escape these flames. We all know that, of course, wood is very flammable. This specific construction building, the base of it was made out of combustible elements like concrete, metal, and then the rest of it was all wood. That is how a lot of developments are being built around here. As you can imagine, it's much cheaper, but it also is not really helpful for our fire department when things like this happen.
And until they put in barriers like drywall and the sprinkler systems, all that stuff is very susceptible to catching on fire. There's nothing to stop it once it starts. And all I found out yesterday in reading about this, that all buildings under construction have a higher fire risk than fully constructed buildings. Jonathan Hart is the technical lead and principal engineer for the National Fire Protection Association. He says the Fire Code Revision Committee will look at adopting a code from that association known as 241.
What we have is a standard NFPA 241, which provides criteria and requirements for how we can protect the site, the workers, the first responders who are going to respond to a scene if there is an incident.
But this isn't going to happen overnight. North Carolina Chief Fire Code Consultant Charlie Johnson says to implement this, it would have to go through a number of committees and councils. If it does that, how long will this take?
As we just mentioned, government works slow. I'm sure this works slow as well. But I will, you know, give them props for immediately trying to do a postpartum on this and try to make things better. We have never seen a fire like that. And so it's really, I think, reassuring to know that they are trying to implement and update policies in which we hopefully will never have to see a fire like that again.
Mary. And you see this building boom we do have in Charlotte. I know my neighborhood is so many things happening. And you go past them and you see welding and all of these things going on. And you realize in real time how it could catch fire. I live just a couple of miles from this South Park fire. And you still could not go outside. You could smell it in the air. It really was really scary. And I know someone who was in a doctor's office right next to it who said they came in and just immediately evacuated. So I think we all pass by construction sites every day. And so this will really give us something to think about and wonder when they are going to really update the codes, because the building is only going to increase. It's not going to, they're going to be building in Charlotte.
Well, Hunter mentioned that government moves slowly, and we've been hearing some moves in Raleigh about the potential of having sports betting legalized. Looks like it may be about to happen after all these years. The Senate voted 38-11 this week to allow it after making changes to a House bill. As one senator said, this is about collecting taxes on something people already do. Why this epiphany that there is revenue to be collected after all the, it's always been there. Why now?
It is quite interesting, Mike, to watch this. And it's a national phenomenon, not just North Carolina. Remember, one of the big things, two big things changed. First, you had a Supreme Court ruling a couple of years ago that allowed this. Beyond Las Vegas and, you know, the few pockets where it was legal. But secondly, the sports leagues themselves have embraced this because they see money and the networks see money. And so if you watch any sporting events, you see nothing but gambling ads now. So you take all that, you roll it up, you have more than half the states now have legalized it. North Carolina went into overtime after the bill surprisingly failed last year, but it looks like they're going to reconcile the version that they have, and the governor said he will sign it. So before you know it, Mike, you will be able to place all of your sports wagers on your phone while you're hosting Charlotte Talks.
Oh, boy, howdy. So this will generate allegedly $70 million once it's implemented. I'm sure the auditors are rubbing their hands together. House Speaker Tim Moore says it's possible a final version of the bill could be combined with legislation allowing more casinos in the state and video lottery terminals as well. Senate Leader Phil Berger is hoping the House will simply approve the Senate bill as is, but he would not rule out a large omnibus bill if it came to that. So when might this happen?
Well, it's definitely going to happen before the end of the session. It could probably happen sooner than that. And the other thing to watch with this, Mike, is that as big as sports betting is, the real money, national experts will tell you, is in your traditional gambling, but online and able to do it on the phone. So watch for that, no doubt, within the next few years, as well as a discussion.
I'm just
curious. And we've got to mention the addiction problems, because folks have brought that up, that this is, of course, going to really make it easier. So also, I think we'll see a boon in counselors for gambling addiction.
I'm just wondering how they regulate it now. How do they stop you from using your phone to bet right now?
Well,
they don't.
Well, now there is GPS that they'll do where they have your location. You have to be within the state. So a lot of people drive across the state line to Tennessee or other places that have it. So that's the argument for is, look, we're losing this money to other states. Let's keep it here.
So when they say Montana wants to ban, I think it's Montana wants to ban TikTok. And people say, well, you can't do that. But, well, you could geofence it. You could ban it. You could turn off the app in Montana. Okay. The General Assembly is also considering bipartisan legislation to address mental health care. It's been described as a major investment in ending a growing crisis. I didn't know this. In which one person dies by suicide every 6 hours in North Carolina. Wow. What would House Bill 855, the Strengthening Care for Families and Children Act due?
Well, I'll take a stab if no one wants that. So what it would do is allocate $1 billion to various aspects of mental health for mental health services in schools, the state psychiatric centers, telehealth for mental health in rural areas. You would increase the reimbursement rates for providers. That's something that hasn't happened for a while, and so they turn down a lot of potential patients. So, and also attracting and keeping mental health workers and professionals. So to your point, Mike, North Carolina is 39th in the U.S. in access to mental health care. So there is a lot of work to be done here. I think the one, not sticking point, but the one question here is, now that the state is looking to take meaningful action with this, what happens in a few years when this money is no longer there? Will they replenish it?
Yeah. Mary, you recently devoted one of your podcasts, your Equal Time podcasts, to what the U.S. Surgeon General describes as the defining public health crisis of our time. What did you
learn? We've seen that the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has said it. And also, he's used his platform because he's highlighting how the country's doing and where it falls short, particularly a lot of young people who are suffering. And in May was Mental Health Awareness Month. And we were talking about how some legislatures are trying to put in place things that would limit access on social media for kids. But we've seen that they're going to get there. And we know that actually social media has helped some folks who are in smaller communities get like-minded people to help them. But we've also seen how it's really made young people distort things like their body image and expectations and expose them to a lot of things. So my guest, who has an organization, Get Media Savvy, talks about media literacy and what not just legislators can do, but also parents and families. Should you let your kid who's 6 years old be on the social media? And so all of this is related to mental health. And so it's an issue that, as Eric and others have said, we're dealing with in North Carolina, but also nationally, and particularly with young people.
And it's getting a lot of media attention. WSSC-TV aired a locally produced special this week on mental health, and WFAE is working with PBS's Frontline on a series called Fractured, which examines many different aspects of mental health, and you can find those podcasts on our website at WFAE.org. We were going to talk last week about Thomas Polk Park. We ran out of time. We're almost running out of time now. This is the park diagonally across the street at Trade and Tryon from the Bank of America Tower and will be renamed after Hugh McCall, although he says he has nothing to do with this, particularly with the controversy surrounding the destruction of a water feature that was designed by an international artist. Eric, tell us more.
Well, as you say, this park is across the street from the bank that Hugh McCall built, and now the new park will be named for him through fundraising from a private coalition. But this started with an effort to save the park as it was, the park that opened in 1991, and the city and Center City Partners determined that it was just going to be too expensive to preserve the fountain. Others, including the Cultural Landscape Foundation, say, not so fast. This could have been preserved. There is technology to make it work. But before they could really have much of a debate, it was already knocked down in the past 10 days or so.
One piece of hyperbole, I think, that came out of this is that this has been compared to, this has been called Charlotte's Penn Station moment. The old Penn Station in New York City was demolished in the early 20th century before preservationists could get their hands on it. And it was an example of Beaux-Arts architecture and would have been saved today had they been able to act more quickly. But really, is this a fair comparison to
no,
that?
No, I think that was that was the hyperbolic arts from our Cultural Landscape Foundation president. But
if that's our Penn Station, it does not say great things about Charlotte.
Yeah, that hurts, doesn't it?
Well, here's something that does. Charlotte's Douglas International Airport, once again, among the top 10 airports for arrivals and departures with near record passenger traffic, making us the seventh busiest airport in the world. But you knew that if you ever tried to park there, that we're ahead of JFK in New York. We're the second hub for American Airlines. They account for 90% of all flights. 48 million people fly through the airport or did in 2022. What does that do for the economy in the state? I have 10 seconds.
$32 billion annual economic impact. It's big.
It's big. Eli Portillo with us from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg was the last voice you heard from the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and Equal Time, and Hunter Sines, reporter for WSOC-TV Channel 9. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.